And that was the St. Louis Blues being whistled to you. Welcome to Encore. I'm your host, Megan Brown. Today, we will be talking about two very special and fun events coming up this week. This Tuesday is the In Your Own Backyard series that happens once a month, the second Tuesday of every month at Vermilionville. And it starts at 6:30. This week, they will be talking about Beekeepers of Acadiana. Emily Neustrom will be there, and I think she helped CSED organize this, and she rounded up a bunch of beekeepers in Acadiana, and they're going to be discussing what all goes into that. They might have some samples, or they might have some to sell. I'm not certain, but it should be a really cool event if you're interested in beekeeping and the harvesting of honey. It should be really, really cool. And they're going to talk about organic ways of harvesting and then normal ways, but maybe a way that most of us are more familiar with than what organic beekeeping is. So it'll be really interesting. But for this show, the In Your Own Backyard series interview that we will be playing will be from last month, and it is on films in Louisiana or about Louisiana, and Glenn Pete and Michelle Benoit will be on that interview talking to you about their past films or any past films in Louisiana. And so that'll be real interesting too. Get out your pen and paper just in case you want to take some notes, write down some movies you might want to watch. It's going to be real good. It'll be coming up in about 15 or so minutes, because we're going to start off with an interview about Festival Acadiana Creole coming up this weekend, October 12th through the 14th at Girard Park here in Lafayette, Louisiana. And it starts, of course, the Friday night, and it goes all the way to Saturday night. It's going to be a lot of fun, as you all know. It'll be 3 days packed with music. Really good music, all ages and all subgenres that fall under Louisiana music. It's going to be really fun. There's 7 tents or stages to go to. Scene Malusian is one of the biggest stages, I guess, the main stage. And that is where the music will be taking place on Friday night. That's the only place music will be taking place on Friday night at the festival. And then, of course, there's Sin Mon Héritage, and that is going to be a good stage to watch the music at as well. Louisiana Bicentennial Stage is, I guess, what you would call the dance hall stage. They have a nice wooden floor down there, and it's usually down in the ditch, kind of, at Girard Park. And there are 2 Louisiana Folk Roots tents. The Atelier tent will be interviews and performances. And then the Folk Roots Jam des Amis tent is where you can bring your instruments and get a chance to jam with some people. And I would also like to note that the UL Lafayette Traditional Music Ensemble will be there at the jam tent Saturday at 2:15 until 3:45. So if you've been wanting to know a little more about the traditional music ensemble here at UL Lafayette, Mark DeWitt will be there. You can find out what classes will be offered next spring and try to find out a way to participate in that if you're interested. Also, there is the Couture sur la Table tent, and that will be a good place to go and have your notebook out as well. Get some recipes, maybe, from some of your favorite chefs in the area. And then there is the La Place des Enfants tent, and that's a great place to bring your children to learn about the culture and music in the culture. And they also do crafts and stories. I see Caroline Helm is going to be doing a story time section, and that will be, it should be very entertaining. So be sure and drop your kids by at that tent. Don't forget, there's also the section with all of the local artists and some out-of-state artists, I imagine, as well. There's always a lot of great art there and jewelry and all different medias of art. And another really important part of the festival, don't forget to stop by and get some food. There will be several tents set up with a lot of delicious food. I like to make my way around the festival. As Elizabeth Rose would say, eat my way through the festival. We all enjoy the food, so make sure you go and stop by and get some food too. So we're going to start off with an interview that I recorded earlier this week with Blake Miller, and then we'll go right into the CSET, the In Your Own Backyard series interviews with Glenn Peet and Michelle Benoit. So, Blake, why don't we start off with who you are, where you're from, what do you do?
My name is Blake Miller. I'm from Iota, Louisiana. I live here in Lafayette now, and I play music. I play with the Red Stick Ramblers, the Lafayette Rhythm Devils, and the Revelers.
All right. And today we're going to be talking just a little bit about Festival Acadien. Blake's going to be sharing some of his first memories and his favorite memories. And we're just going to talk a little bit about the festival. Blake, what's your first memory of Festival Acadien et Créole?
Well, I grew up going to Festival Acadien et Créole, but I don't really remember the first time I went because I was so young. I'm pretty much going every year of my life because of my grandpa who had his accordion booth at the festival all those years. So my first memories were going and hanging out at his booth back when the planetarium used to be down the road and the crafts fair was over there. So they would have jams over there, and I just remember hanging out and listening to the music and all visiting all the craft sites and then walking down the road and going to see the bands that were playing on the stages that were just down the road.
Who would jam with y'all at your grandfather's tent? Anyone and everyone? Do you remember the musicians?
It was just kind of, people would come in and out. It was kind of anybody and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the young kids at that time would often pass by and jam.
All right. And when was the first time that you played at Festival Acadien et Créole?
Well, I guess the first time would have been maybe 2005.
With the Pine Leaf Boys?
Yeah, we weren't called the Pine Leaf Boys at the time, but it was the Pine Leaf Boys, yeah. Yeah. I think we had Chris Stafford on, I think it was me on the bass and Chris Stafford on the guitar maybe, and then Cedric on fiddle and Wilson on accordion, and Drew on drums.
What was that like, your first time playing at a festival?
That was, it was like a dream come true, you know, been going to this festival for all these years and getting to play on one of the stages. It was in the tent. It was in the Heritage tent at the time because the Heritage stage was still a tent. It was great. We were first on like Saturday or Sunday, so there weren't many people out, but it was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, that's cool. And what is your, I know you've played several times at festivals since then. What's your favorite moment? What's your favorite moment on stage at Festival Acadien?
Well, I guess I have two. One would be, I forget what year it was, but we closed the main stage, San Malusian, out one year on Saturday. We played last band on Saturday night, and it was a beautiful day. It hadn't rained that year at all, and it was super crowded. There was so many people out, and it was just a great experience to like be the last band of the day.
Yeah, it's always so pretty to see the sun kind of go down.
Yeah.
And the band with the lights. I don't know. It's a really pretty scene.
And then watch the horses come and chase everybody off. That was, it was great. It was kind of a cool thing to be. It was a different view of the whole experience that I've experienced like every year. Mm-hmm. And but probably my favorite experience was just, was it last year or the year before? I got to play twin fiddles with Jason Fry, with Walter Muto and the Scott Playboys. That was probably the number one experience of my life, let alone just Festival La Carian.
Yeah, that was last year, I think.
Yeah.
I think I have some photos of that. Cool. And what are you looking forward to this year? I know you've been looking at the schedule. Who are you excited to see play this year?
Well, it's always great when they have Walter Mouton up there. That's going to be great. Mm-hmm. Fofolé is going to be great, closing out the stage on Saturday night. Wayne Toops is always fun to go and see on Sunday with his giant Cajun orchestra. Let's see. The Macaulay Reed Vidrine reunion and Shadi Vadi reunion and with the Laffy Rhythm Devils, which I'm going to get to be a part of, that should be really great.
That should be real good, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. All those guys are so much fun to be around and play music with. I don't know. Just there's so many things going on. Lost by Your Ramblers, Bonsoir Cartin. This should all be just a great festival.
Yeah. And if you haven't checked out the schedule, or even know when Festival Acadien et Creole is this year, it is October 12th through the 14th. And you can go online to the website. And the website is Festival, and Festival has an S on it. acadienecreole.com, and you can select French or English from there. If you're not certain how to spell everything, you can just search it in Google and the website will come up. But you can pick French or English, and they've got the schedules. They've also got who will be serving food and what they will be serving, and that is a huge part of the festival. Blake, what's your favorite dish that you get every year? Do you have one?
I don't really have one. I usually like to get the, I think it's the fried catfish with the etouffee on it from, I think it's Imanelli's that does that? I forget who does it.
I'm not sure who does it, but that's a really good dish.
I always have to get that every year.
I really like the crawfish and spinach boat.
Oh, yeah.
So good. But, so you can go to the website, and it will take place Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, October the 12th through the 14th at Girard Park here in Lafayette. And on Friday, Joel Saunier will start off at 5:30 and play till 6:45. And right after him is Little Band of Gold with a bunch of special guests, I'm sure. And that'll be real fun to watch.
Oh yeah, Jeffy, come on down, you are fine. Baba, Judy, are you down, everybody?
And that was John Delafosse and the Zydeco Machine with Oya Titfi from Festival Acadien y Creole 1981. If you're just joining us for Encore, we're going to go now into the In Your Own Backyard series interview with Glenn Peet and Michelle Benoit on film, talking about film in Louisiana or films about Louisiana. So like I said earlier, get your pen and paper out and take some notes if you want to maybe watch the movies or films they talk about. And we'll go into that. That's how we'll close out the show. I know we have a lot of time left, but it'll be good. Y'all stay tuned.
When you started making movies, you know, Bel Air being the most well-known, but even before that, you were doing movies in Cajun French. Mm-hmm. Was it in the back of your movie maker mind that you wanted to portray South Louisiana in a certain way, or did that even figure into the equation?
I think I stumped him.
No, I mean, it was a lot more personal. I wanted to tell family stories, and you know, I was growing up in a town where, you know, French was the first language of virtually every adult. And, you know, kids younger than me weren't speaking French. Even a lot of my friends weren't speaking French. And so that seemed like a shame. So I started telling family stories in French. And you know, but I kind of wanted to, you know, make my version of the buccaneer. So, I mean, I'd do costume. You know, we're in present day circa late 1970s. But it was, you know, things set in my first movie was set in 1897 during a yellow fever epidemic. You know, the next one was set during the shrimp war of 1938. You know, so it was, and they were in French. But I wouldn't try to say this is what Cajuns are. I was trying to say, you know, here's a family story. You know, here's a story from my town. Here's what people remember. And oftentimes playing with, you know, what people remember and what weren't always the same. When I started to do that movie on the shrimp war,
850.
We piastre de mie, 850. Because that's what they wanted for a barrel of shrimp. A barrel is 210 pounds, a lot of shrimp. They were only getting $6. And I had the old guy, so it was basically a fisherman's strike in the 1930s, and I had the old guy who was head of the fisherman's union down in Golden Meadow, and he was going to tell the story, and, you know, the town was going to reenact it and everything else. And then I run across his cousin, who had got hired by the cannery to break the strike, and he had his version of the story, and he had his kids and his grandsons who wanted to reenact it, but they wanted to reenact it their way. You know, so you start to see that, you know, how do you tell the truth when there's lots of versions of the truth? You know, and when history has already started turning into myth, and there's just no way to really nail it down, which was fun. But that's a far cry from saying this is, you know, this, you know, if you look at that movie, you might, you know, and think this is the portrait of what Cajuns are, you're going to say, Well, they're all either liars or deluded, because these two guys are saying things and they're saying opposite things, which was never my, you know, it's not my intent to say we're liars or deluded.
Which is sort of one of the interesting aspects of filmmaking, and you touched on that, is that to have a dynamic story, you have to have somebody who's right, somebody's wrong, the person who was right is now wrong, and the person who was, so you have that give and take and that narrative structure going back, and sometimes people that you like are the bad guys, and sometimes they aren't. So, you know, it's up to interpretation. Sometimes those are Cajun, sometimes they're not. You know, sometimes it's the mafia, sometimes it's not. And it's a very interesting, and in our work, we've done feature films that are narrative based on fictional scripts, and we've done a lot of documentaries. And there's always sort of that moment in a documentary where you have a lot of footage, you know, and you're putting the story together, and you have a responsibility to how you're going to portray people, you know? So, you know what I mean?
Do you portray them like you think they are? Do you portray them like you think they want to be portrayed, you know? And especially nowadays with video, you shoot and shoot and shoot, so you got all the footage, you can do it anyway. You can make them look good, look bad. I mean, you know, you can create conflict where there is none, just with subtle editing. So it's tricky. And then when you put a layer on top of that, that this person is not just this person, but this person is representative of a place, of a group,
or a subject, or a theme,
of what they do. I was talking with a gentleman earlier about Traiteros, because one of the films we had done, it was on Louisiana folk medicine, and we had 10 different
folk healers.
Yeah, 10 different healers portrayed in it. And, you know, that thing, you know, we did it in partnership with LPB. So they showed it. It wore out the tape. They showed it so often. And every time it would show, I would get people who were mad at me because they thought I was making fun of this. I get people who were mad at us because they thought we were making Louisiana look backward by showing this. And then I was having people calling up to say, can you give us the phone numbers of these folks? Because, you know, we need their help.
Lots of that. And, you know, and that was a case where...
Is that a sign of success? Or, I mean, it's like you've got all these different reactions.
Yeah, as a filmmaker, you really do have that responsibility when you have all that footage and you're telling someone's story and you have that moment that... could be an outtake, it could be something that happened unintentionally, it could be a conversation that veered off in a place you didn't expect, but you the filmmaker has the responsibility of portraying the person, you know, and there's this moment where you know you can take it in one way or the other, like you just said. Mm-hmm. You can make that person a little less believable, a little more believable, a little, it's a very interesting sort of line to walk in documentaries, at least, and in fiction.
Because the reality is, I mean, we are creatures of ego, and of course we're always worried about the next gig. So our first concern is, how do we keep people watching? You know, we want them to get to the end. You know, we want them to stick with it and want to see the next thing we do. So you want to make it interesting, but you want to be fair to the people involved at the same time.
A little bit of both.
You know, a little bit of both. I mean, documentary certainly with fiction films. They're fiction films. It gets a little dicey sometimes because they're, you know, if you're doing a biography, if you're doing it based on somebody who really existed, if you're doing it on real events. We did a movie called The Man Who Came Back. It starred
Eric Braeden.
Eric Braeden, who's at Young and the Restless, you know, Victor Newman on Young and the Restless every day. It starred him and Billy Zane, who was the villain in Titanic. And
Sean Young. And
old George Kennedy, who got the Oscar for... with the Paul Newman movie.
Yeah, that one.
So anyway, we're doing this. It's, you know... What happened there was, I get the call. I mean, you know, in Los Angeles, I get the call. We want you to write and direct this script. I go, great. I read it. It's a Western horror film, and the script's unreadable. I mean, it's awful. It's terrible. And I do what you're never supposed to do. I go in and say, look, I'm hungry, and I can't make this. Nobody can make this. I mean, this thing doesn't make sense. And the producer, to my surprise, goes, I'm so glad you said that. Okay. So rewrite. He goes, you got to give it some historical weight. That's why we want you. So we got rid of the horror element, so it's a Western.
And Glenn says, what story in Louisiana story have I been dying to tell?
And so I had the story of the Thibodeau Massacre, which happened in, I mean, a short version is post-slavery, you know, the former slaves are still working for the sugar plantations, and they're in some ways worse off than they were before. Because when they were property, at least they had a certain value to the people who were hiring them. Now they were expendable. And they went on strike, and there was a massacre where, depending on whose account you read, there are between 60 and 300 people killed, bodies tossed in the swamp. Strike ended. There wasn't another strike in the sugar fields until the 1950s. So that became the historical weight. But this is Hollywood.
There was a large body count.
And Hollywood's version of history is wiggly, shall we say. So there was that, you know, that battle throughout. And, you know, there were days I go, why did I ever open my mouth on this? Because, you know, we are not telling the story of the Thibodeau Massacre, although it's kind of being referenced and called to that. This is basically a revenge Western, which is fine. If that's what you want to see, that's fine. You know, I like the movie. It's a little more violent than I like, but I'm proud of what I did. But, you know, was it faith, you know, historically accurate? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, did I say, that's terrible, I'm taking my name off of it? Absolutely not. You know, I got out there and promoted it all I could and get people to watch it. And you can get it off of Netflix, you know, but you do what you do. You go on to the next one.
I don't know where to go from there.
Well, where I was going before
oh, good,
you interrupted was after...
I'm sorry, what?
What's that? The Man Who Came Back. Man Who Came Back.
And he was mad.
And he was mad. He was mad.
Very bloody.
I was saying Southern Comfort came out. Shy People came out about that time. You know, the bad taste from the good times are killing me was still there.
Right.
And I showed up in Lafayette, but 28 years old, not knowing my butt from a hole in the ground, said, I'm making a movie here. And we did Bel Air the Cajun, which was, you know, for a, you know, you can't choose your timing, you know, you just, you know, when you get the horse, you run, and when the horse is in the barn, you walk. But it just so happened that we got to do that movie at a time when you know, Lafayette was ripe for it, Louisiana was ripe for it, the country was ripe for it. And, you know, so here we're telling a story where the hero is Cajun. And he's a trickster. And he doesn't have the power, but he manages to outwit all, you know, all the powers that be. And we did that movie here. That was in the spring of 1985. And, you know, it was an amazing experience. People turned out. We had, you know, literally hundreds of extras. You know, it's set in 1859, so everybody's in costume. We had horses. We took over Acadian Village for months and, you know, built sets and changed things and everything else. And when it opened, it... Was it Times of Acadiana? I still have the copy. The Times of Acadiana called the opening of the movie "The Event of the Millennium in Lafayette." Now that's a little much. I'll admit it's a little much. But it gives you a sense of, you know, so many people coming up and saying, finally, you know, you give us an image to be proud of. Finally, you make us look like we not fools. And you know.
But, and it's interesting because, you know, because Bélezère is a trickster. He's not completely good all the time. You've got
Yul Brynner would have turned down the part.
You got Polyte, mm-hmm. who's kind of a drunk, you know. So there, you've got some equivocal images of Cajuns in there.
The sheriff was played by my dad's a crook.
He was pretty much of a crook, but it had it left such a good feeling for people because it was at a moment where there was a lot of sort of questions about, you know, Cajuns, backwoods, no teeth. But bad guys, and also, you're right, it was that synergistic moment when Cajun music was just coming up, you know, when,
you know,
the Festival Acadien was just getting started, you know, and there so was this whole, by the way, Randy LaBrie is here.
But again, it was...
Randy LaBrie is here, speaking of Bélezère the Cajun.
I hear him, but I don't see him. production designer. He's fellow responsible for how the movie looks.
If you liked how Bélezère looks, that's why for
and,
Andy
and
LaBrie.
And again, we have some DVDs, so we're going to do a little merchandising after. But that one, too, I mean, people brought to it, you know, people were hungry for a positive image. And so in a lot of ways, I think, made that character more positive than he was actually written and played in some ways. Some people, the whole last act of the movie, there's this great big set piece gallows scene. And it's you know, Bélezère, the main character, on the gallows. And on either side of him are two of the vigilantes who are going to get hung at the same time. And, you know, I had so many people come and say... Yeah, you know, Bélezère, he was a Christ figure. That's why you put the two thieves on him. It's like the crucifixion. And that had never, ever, ever entered my mind.
Lynn was just thinking symmetry.
It's just
symmetry.
Wide screen. The movie screen's wide, so you put someone either side because you're going to spend so much time on this. So people bring their own, what they care about. But again, that's a good story. A good story is when you know, everybody can nail one more shingle to it that means something to them.
So do you think that, and there has been a shift of portrayal of Louisiana and Cajuns in South Louisiana, because it's Louisianians are finally getting behind the camera and making these movies themselves, and Louisiana documentary makers are now the ones who are doing it, and Louisiana, you know, photographers and storytellers are the ones like Greg who actually get out and aren't waiting for the outside world to come and say what Louisiana is. But is that part of the big change?
I mean, I think part of it is, you know, I mean, certainly documentaries have been democratized because, yeah, I mean, cameras everywhere. There are cameras everywhere. And you can go and you can make your stuff and widely, but you can go there and make yourself, and you know that's made a difference. So you get stuff done from the inside, as opposed to too frequently from the outside of the culture. You have, you know, certainly in fiction films, there's a lot more Louisiana portrayals now because of the tax incentives. You know, so much is shooting here. And if it's kind of a generic story, they'll say, well, we're in Louisiana, might as well set it in Louisiana. You know, so you have that. Is it more accurate? You know, I think the same issues still come along. I mean, you still have people... You know, when you're making a drama, you're more concerned about keeping the audience glued to the screen. than other issues. And when you're making a documentary, you know, you're bringing your own prejudices. Sometimes the things from the inside, when you're inside the culture, you have a narrow view. You know, so, you know, is there a happy medium? No, you keep cranking, and every now and then you get lucky, you know, and sometimes you manage to get the little lightning bug into the bottle and it glows for a while.
So when I was watching the reel, I don't know how many of y'all saw the thing that was playing, but that was our reel. And there were some like 28 movies in there.
28 movies.
Want to talk about some of those?
Sure. I mean, that's, you know, again, portrayals of Louisiana. I mean, between we do movies, you know, big, you know, things. We do documentaries, we do museum films, the things, you know, exhibits in museums. So we come at that kind of storytelling from a lot of different directions for a lot of different purposes, you know, aimed at different audiences. And sometimes, you know, sometimes...
Not always about Louisiana, but we've been very fortunate that we have been able to tell a lot of Louisiana stories, like... You know, the air racers. I don't know how many of y'all been to the Weedell Williams Museum in Patterson. Anybody been out there? Huh? Oh, look at that. You have to go. It's this really great museum. On one side is the history of Cyprus in Louisiana, and the other side is the aviation museum. There was this amazing group of hot rod airplane racers in the 30s there. And it was all kind of funded by this rich guy from New Orleans, Harry Williams.
Patterson.
From Patterson.
The Patterson Lumber Company.
Yeah, the Patterson Lumber Company. He was kind of the mayor of Patterson, you know, and he would come in and they were, you know, racing these, just building these monster engines to just plane race.
Racing
it was
cars.
All out of Patterson.
It set up pylons and go around.
In the 1930s.
They don't quite do it the same way anymore because it was the people who get killed too often.
You know, and that was a great...
But they were like the cutting edge back
in
the
Patterson.
Early 30s until they all died in plane crashes.
Everybody in the United States knew about, you know, Jimmy Weedell and Harry Williams and their racing planes in Patterson. You know, so that was one of those moments where we got approached to do a film, and it was so much fun to... Because obviously you can tell I was excited about it. But this was a story of Louisiana that I just did not know that much about. I mean, I knew that there was Harry Williams, and he'd married a silent screen movie star.
Yeah, he married like the Julia Roberts of his day, who's a silent screen star. Made her quit the business and move to New Orleans. If you know the
Ladder
Library on St. Charles Avenue, that was their house in New Orleans.
And that's all I knew.
They had the big place down in Patterson.
And also because we had done a documentary called Haunted Waters, Fragile Land, about the Barataria-Terrebonne Estuary. And we had actually used some footage of Cyprus logging that was from the Williams that was probably happened around Patterson. So there were these little bits of, it's like, oh, this interesting things that I kind of knew about it, and I got to put it all together. Yeah. Part of the fun of being a filmmaker is sort of being a detective. You get to put all the layers together, and what is it that makes it interesting to the people who are going to sit in the seat and watch this? Of course, if you're going to the Weedell Williams Aviation Museum in Patterson, you should all go. But you sort of have somebody who might be interested in aviation. So there's a little bit you get given.
The movie theater movies are more glamorous, but these museum films for us are so much fun because you know it's going to be showing in one place. So you get to play. And you know, for instance, we saw this one and said, well, you know, really, it shouldn't be like a movie. It should be like the cockpit. It should surround you. You should have three screens. And the people's, you know, State Museum goes, okay. So I said, oh,
we're
okay,
like, let's ask him for something else.
I said, well, you know, there's this whole air race sequence. You know, really, you know, you want people to feel like they're in the plane. They got to feel the wind. We're going to need all these fans built into the theater ceiling and synchronized to the film. And they go, okay. Wow, we can play with this. We can play with this. So, I mean, sometimes you know, we did another one for the State Museum that plays in the every 15 minutes in the presbytery, right next to St. Louis Cathedral in Jackson Square. And it was the sort of the finale of their Katrina exhibit. And they said, we need a film that's about Katrina, but they've just been through the exhibit. People are ready to walk out. They want to slit their wrist. It's so depressing.
It's a very good exhibit if you go to New Orleans. Movie. But it's intense. Yeah. So this was sort of the summation of that exhibit. Yeah. And they wanted something that sort of put it all into perspective.
Yeah. So we did that, but we also had them found about 50 windows from houses that had been demolished in the storm and built a wall of all these windows and took out all the glass and stripped the wood and then reglazed the windows with like dark gray plexiglass. So it's like a wall of all these different shaped windows with black glass in them. Only 14 of those windows have TV monitors hidden behind them. So you sit there and, you know, somebody starts to tell the story and you see it and then it pops up here and pops up here and pops up here. And then we had the lightning and thunder effects. So, you know, you get to do a little bit of theatrical. I don't know what that has to do with the portrayal of Louisiana in the movies, but it was fun.
I think we're on to storytelling now.
We're on storytelling. Yeah.
Our Scoundrel's Wife, which is, you might know as Homefront, came out on DVD as Homefront, which is the World War II home front, what was happening on the bayous during World War II, what the Louisiana...
Oh, man, heard some stories.
We heard some stories, and it was a lot of the things that happened in that we used in the movie were things that we had heard people tell the stories of, but it was, and very specifically in the Bayou Lafourche area, but as we talked to people and told them, you know, would pitch them the story or tell them what the story was, or as they saw the movie, they were like, yeah, but that really happened in, you know, in Delcom. No, that really happened in Cameron. Right. You know, so there's this wonderful commonality of things that happen. Yeah. What did you say?
Yeah, it's the same tales.
It's the same tales that get repeated of, you know.
The only story on that is in 1942, there were 60-something ships sunk just off the coast, the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and Texas. By German U-boats. And, you know, as you might imagine, people were kind of freaked out. And so there was this rumors running rampant that people, that fishermen and coastal people were helping the U-boats, helping the enemy, were selling them supplies. And after the war, they found out that they had essentially submarine tankers that would come as far as the Caribbean so they could refuel, but they didn't know that during the war, so they figured there's no way these German submarines could come this far and operate this much, so they had to have help from the local fishermen, and
there was a lot of suspicion, but also at the same time there were, even your mother remembers, you know, playing cards that were called spotter cards, so you knew the shapes of the enemy airplanes in case you saw it going overhead. And I mean, all kids had to learn this, you know, and there was trash, you know, cash for your trash. There was a metal collection. So there was this real, you know, you couldn't hang out your laundry because that could signal to the U-boats, and they were blackout at night. So there was this real sense of paranoia. Yeah. And, you know, and there was this whole, how are they staying out there? Where are they getting their food? Where are they getting their fuel? There must be people helping them. It must be that, you know, bad neighbor of mine down the road who doesn't talk to me or doesn't go to church, you know, so those things sort of go crazy. You get suspicious, right? Yeah. So that's
in my town, they ran the priest out of town.
Who's
played by Tim Curry in the movie.
He spoke German.
One of the best stories, we didn't work it into the film, but one of the best stories I heard about was from Harold Scheffler here in Lafayette, had the Cadillac dealership, whose father was a big gun collector and was also like a second generation American, first generation American. His Scheffler, it was a German name, it was a German family. And so the FBI was coming to get all his guns. Yeah, this wasn't going to happen. But, you know, he was a prominent local citizen, so the sheriff showed up the day before and picked up all his guns. The FBI came, they found nothing. They left, and the sheriff came by the next day and brought all his guns back so he could have his guns, because the local guy knew he was not, you know, he was not working with the enemy. But
yeah, there were a lot of good stories that we didn't have time to put in that movie.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, the the best, and I still don't believe this, but the best was the fisherman who would leave Grand Isle, cut east just off the beach at Grand Terre, and where they used to graze cattle. This is on Barataria Bay. And would wait till one of the cows got too close to the beach. They'd stop the boat. They'd aim, shoot it, swim to shore with a lead line, pull the heavier line out, tie up the steer, haul it back to the boat, ride it back. The guy who swam out would ride the dead steer back to the boat. They'd winch it up, and they would cut it into steaks so when they met the U-boat to sell it fuel, they could also sell it fresh meat.
There's all,
now, how many laws are you breaking?
And when we would talk to people, even in cutoff, about, you know, those stories,
that
and
was,
you know,
Mr. Sheridan.
Did you ever exactly?
They had names,
did,
name,
did
names.
You ever hear about anybody who would sell, you know, food? He said, "Oh yeah, they were selling that Dufresne's bread, and that was Mr. So and So." And they would actually name people, but you know, he needed the money, you know, or whatever. But those same kinds of stories happen. My friends in Massachusetts and in the Carolinas tell the same stories, only in, you know, North Carolina. It's like, oh, yeah, they were selling them sweet potatoes, you know? So it's just a regional whatever is.
Yeah, yeah. It was called The Scoundrel's Wife when it was in theaters, and then the distributor took it for DVD, and that was right around 9/11. 11 years ago today, a little after that, and they wanted a more patriotic title, so they renamed it Homefront.
Your turn.
Yeah, I wanted to maybe piggyback on the question before about Hollywood representation, and my particular interest is in horror films and representation of Louisiana, just as a personal hobby. And I wondered what your impression of more contemporary or modern films that are still portraying Southern Louisiana, and maybe not necessarily Cajun, but New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Lafayette area. What your impression was of that, and you know, and you'd mentioned Southern Comfort, which was I think filmed in '81.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of other films, just to name a couple, like Hatchet, Creature, Skeleton Key. These are all within the past 5 years.
Oh, yeah, and lots more. I mean, what was the one Michael Arata did in the hospital?
Yeah.
I mean, they go off the road and they land in a hospital, and it's like, you know, hospital's been closed forever, and it's this Louisiana doctor who's Dr. Mingla, you know, Boudreaux, you know, kind of thing.
So, well, my question along that line is, I guess, when is Hollywood, or when do you think Hollywood, or will they ever stop portraying a particular stereotype of this particular region of the country? And I'm not from here. I'm from New Jersey. So before I moved here, people told me, "You sure you want to move to Southern Louisiana? Have you seen Southern Comfort?" That's what I was told. So, you know, I just wondered what you were thinking.
You know, but
about
the
that.
Same thing could be said about the Coen brothers in Minnesota, you know. So, you know, so it's sort of like it's Louis, there's still this mystique, and inherently swamps are weird, mysterious places. So there's this, as a filmmaker, you're always looking for ways to telegraph creepiness, you know. And if I've got a location that the minute somebody sees it, they go like, oh, gosh, I would never want to be stuck there alone with weird noises. Then half your job's done. So it's unfortunate, but it makes it really easy to use this area for that vehicle.
But also, let's put you in the director's chair. Okay, you've got $1.8 million, and it's your chance to make your first movie, and you're going to make this horror movie, and it's going to be the best horror movie ever seen. You're sure about it. You know, even though everybody tells you the script needs work, what do they know? You know, you're going to make your movie, and you know, it's a horror movie, you know? So, you know, how do you keep people scared? You know, how do you make it work? Well, you know, you add a little bit of realism. So these generic, you know, bad people, sort of cretins from the dark, these boogeymen, well, we're going to make them a little realistic because we're going to make them, you know, a real group of people who is there.
You know, are you talking about Nutria Man?
Yeah, Nutria Man. Have you ever seen Nutria Man? Nutriman. Nutriman was done in the late 80s, early 90s. And it's just what you think. And it's
you know, so there's an example.
It's a guy in a Nutria suit, you know, like lives. There's this wonderful scene. I wish they had a subtitle because the guy in the Nutria suit is going, rrr, rrr, and then they got a shot of a real Nutria, and you hear, rrr, rrr, and they're having a conversation. I go, oh, they should have subtitled that. So, yeah. But they didn't.
Contemporary movies now. I mean, how many of y'all seen Lord Byron by Zach Godshaw? Lord Byron, Zach Godshaw's movie, which was shot here, and y'all don't know who Zach Godshaw is? All of his movies go to Sundance. He's a local boy, and he done real good.
Well, how about
Ben's movie. There's a movie, Lord Byron, and it's a character. It's, you know, he uses a lot of non-actors. I mean, and it was a huge success because it was so innovative and so fresh. Was it a good portrayal of Louisiana and Louisianians? You know, that's for you to decide. But it was, you know, I would not have not wanted that movie to be made. You know, it wasn't exactly the most flattering portrayal, but it was a really interesting movie made by somebody who has a quirky point of view and who's making movies in the backyard of Lafayette and having a huge success at it. I mean, that's has its own validity.
This, another example is a very dear friend of ours, late 20s, who made a movie, his first movie,
his first feature.
Feature-length movie, and it's called Beast of the Southern Wilds. And he shot it in Montague and Isle-Jean-Charles and Pointe-aux-Chenes down in Terrebonne Parish. It, you know, won the grand prize at the Sundance Festival. It won the Camera d'Or de Cannes Festival. Just won the prize at Deauville, the big French festival for
American. It's doing amazingly well. Here's another example. It's sort of the same example of Lord Byron. I mean, it's a movie that's really... He makes use of the Louisiana environment and some of the things that we love about Louisiana. And you can take it, if you take it literally, I think you would be really offended. If you take it as a myth and a Homeric journey, you know, a wider fable on the human condition, then you might get inspiration from it. So it just depends on which way, and I can look at it both ways and appreciate it in a lot of different ways. But that's
an example. You know, it's been praised. You know, I don't think it's had a bad review, but I've had a few people come up and say, "But it makes Cajuns look stupid." And I go, "Cajuns?" And they say, "Well, there's Cajun music in the soundtrack." And I go, "Well, you know."
It's tricky. It's a tricky line.
Because again, what's on the screen is not the whole movie. It's what's on the screen plus what's on the head of everybody who walks into the auditorium to watch it.
And just as we all...
And that's the great thing as well as, you know...
That's the good thing about art. We can all stand in front of the same picture, or we can all see the same dance, we can all listen to the same music, we can all see the same film, and every one of us is going to come away with a little bit of a different take, you know, because there are different things that resonate in story in our own personal lives that either irritate us, make us happy, make us angry, and that's what art is, you know.
I had a gig once to do, now let me preface by saying I had never been, you know, west of California.
And that, if you're just joining, at the end of the show was Glenn Peet and Michelle Benoit talking about their experiences with film, making film, and kind of reviewing of other films about or filmed in Louisiana. And that was an interview taken from CSET's In Your Own Backyard series that happens every second Tuesday of the month at Vermilionville at 6:30. And again, this Tuesday, they will be discussing beekeeping in Acadiana with a bunch of beekeepers from around the area and Emily Lustrum. So I hope you can all make it out there. They always have great food. Also, another upcoming event, Festivals Acadiana Creole, will be this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, October 12th through the 14th. I hope to see you all there. I hope to dance with some of you, maybe. It's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of great food, a lot of good music. So thanks for joining me today. Also, I'd like to remind you all that the fundraiser, the KRVS fundraiser, is coming up. If you'd like to support us, you can go to the website, krvs.org, or you can call us, 482-5787, 482-KRVS. You can call us and donate, or donate online. It's a great, secure website, and we really appreciate your support. You've been listening to Encore, produced at the Cypress Lake Studios on the campus of UL Lafayette, and we join you in support of KRVS Public Radio for Acadiana. So thanks for tuning in today. We're going to go out with a little song from the Festivals Acadiana Creole CD, Les Quatre Coins de Saint-Malo. Have a great rest of the weekend. See you at all these events coming up.